Good evening, friends. In our first meeting, we talked about the scope of theosophy and how it covers the essence of philosophy, science, religion, and art. And in our second meeting, we talked about the septenary nature of our universe. This evening, we will deal with the sevenfold nature of our human nature and our consciousness. We will relate it to consciousness and discuss it around the idea of consciousness as they relate to the universe and our human nature. What we will try to do is to go into the different views as some theosophical authors have used regarding this human nature that we have. We may probably research and look over the things we have read and materials that are available. For myself, I have not found any view of our human nature as clear as the theosophical view. In fact, so clear is the theosophical view that it is almost a master key in interpreting many of the mysteries and religions of the world regarding the understanding of our human nature. So here in the first column on the board, which is the same one you have in the sheet, so if you do not have a copy, then it is available at the door. We have here what we might call the key. What we have done here is to merely use ordinary modern terms. So we will begin from down below and then move upwards. So down below, we have now here what we call the physical nature. And this physical nature, sometimes called the physical body, through this we express our physical consciousness. Now this physical nature that we have is divided into two, the solid, liquid, and gaseous state of physical matter constitutes our dense physical nature. Then the etheric states, from downwards moving upwards, so above the gaseous we have what we call the plasmatheric state, then the biotheric state, and then the chemotheric, and then the atomotheric state. All these four substates of physical matter constitutes now our etheric physical nature. And through this we express our etheric consciousness. Maybe of what is going on today, most of the psychic phenomena and psychic experiences most likely are confined in these etheric states. So when people feel that they see auras, that there are certain things that are happening that are almost ghost-like in nature, they refer to this etheric state of physical matter. And we look at this from our human nature from a consciousness point of view. So this is the consciousness or etheric consciousness that transcends the solid, liquid, and gaseous state of physical matter. And then a much finer state of matter occurs, and through this we also express a much higher form of consciousness, and we simply call this our emotional consciousness. Sometimes this is called the astral. What we will do is we will go over the first column just quickly and then relate it laterally or horizontally with the other views as expressed by other theosophical authors, so that when we are doing our own reading and on studying, when we come across certain terms, although they may be different, then we can know and see right away what they are talking about. Because they may talk about the same things we are discussing here, but they may use different terminologies. So above the etheric, we were saying, we have the emotional, sometimes called the astral. So this is a form of consciousness through which we are able to feel emotions. Sometimes this is called astral. This is the first state, what is state of what they say is the after-death state. In other words, when we lay aside our physical body, and we will be discussing in more detail the nature of death and consciousness in our next meeting. But for now, we will simply say that this is a world all its own and a consciousness all its own beyond the physical. It is the beginning of the death consciousness state. But while we live here in the physical world, this is a consciousness all its own. Sometimes they refer to this also as an emotional body. So besides having a physical body through which we exercise physical action, as we have also emotions, so this is a state also where we have an emotional body through which we express emotional consciousness. Then the next above this is the mental, and we divide this into two, the rational mental and the abstractional mental. And we made this differentiation the last time. The rational mental is that level of consciousness where we rationalize using ideas, where the words we use, which is verbal in nature, can be related to an object that we can point to directly as a referent. So we call this our state or level of objective thinking. Then the abstractional state is that state where the thinking is largely subjective. Through this, we are able to think ideas where we cannot point to them as a concrete object the way we can do it at this rational mental level. This rational mental consciousness is the level of ideas, and the abstractional mental is the level of ideals. So we add the letter L and S. So when we have ideas, and through ideas we rationalize and exercise our logic, we are reusing the rational mental. In fact, we said it takes two ideas to become logical. If we have only one idea, it is not possible to be logical or to exercise rational thinking or our rational mental faculty. It takes at least two ideas. So when we have two ideas and start relating them, then we create another third idea, which becomes now the rules of logic, the way the two other ideas should be governed. When we do that, we are dealing in the realm of ideas and using now our rational mental consciousness. This level of consciousness is a consciousness all its own that can also be divorced from the emotional and the physical. They may be related, but it is another level of existence all by itself. So if we might say one did not have a physical body and an emotional body, one can still have a rational mental body and have an existence all its own at this level. We take these two together, and above the rational mental, we have the abstractional, and this is the level now of ideals. That is why the moment we live a life where we try as much as possible to idealize our ideals or to live a life with ideals, what we are doing in our consciousness is we are awakening this level of consciousness. Most people are concerned really at this rational level. They have ideas. You know, in the jobs where we work, they do not look for ideal men. They look for men of ideas, you know. The more ideas you have, they say, then you are creative. If you have ideals, in fact, when one is too idealistic, they will even say, oh, you are not practical. You don't belong to this company or to this job. But this is the realm of ideals. But when one lives a life of ideals, one begins to awaken this higher mental or abstractional mental faculty within one's consciousness. Of course, our creativity really begins at this level, the abstractional level. Then there is another level of consciousness, which we call the intuitional level of consciousness. It enables us to perceive truth, reality, or understanding directly without going through any process of reasoning whatsoever. In fact, it transcends the mental. The mental, we might say, may be called a verbal level of consciousness, and beginning at this intuitional level of consciousness, we have now the non-verbal state of consciousness. This is that state of consciousness where we enter into experiences that have no relationship, later on they may have, whatsoever with words. It transcends words, it transcends ideals, and transcends ideas. But at this level, the ideals now become virtues. The source of virtues are in our intuitional consciousness, and this is in us. So when we say we are trying to be virtuous or trying to awaken virtue, this virtue is not something outside that we incorporate within our consciousness. All the virtues in their full development are already here at the intuitional level of consciousness, and this is within us. All that we are doing is merely trying to bring about this intuitional level of consciousness, that is the level of all virtues, merely at the physical level. In a way, it sort of filters first to the ideals. So we have certain ideals, and then we rationalize this with certain ideas, and then we express this in feelings and emotions. And then finally, at the physical level, it becomes now action. We simply say that when ideals are put into action, then this is the level of virtue. So at the level of virtue, it is not an idea or ideal within one's consciousness. At this level of consciousness, it is instantaneous in the sense that it expresses itself directly with action. And that happens when this intuitional consciousness is awakened within us. Then there is here, in this diagram, it is the highest here, there is still much more above this, but for our basic philosophy, the highest in this is the volitional or the will state of consciousness. This consciousness is the source of power within us. All powers of consciousness are the intuitional, the mental, both abstractional and rational, the emotional, and then the physical, both etheric and then physical. All power arises from this volitional state of consciousness. When this is withdrawn, then the intuitional, the mental, the emotional, the physical, as it were, cannot proceed all by itself. This volitional consciousness is the integrating consciousness within our human nature. Now, in the Secret Doctrine by Blavatsky, she had her own way of using terms referring to our human nature. Notice that at the volitional and intuitional level, there is no difference. So at the volitional level, she used the word Atma. So when the word Atma is encountered, it refers to this volitional level of consciousness. It is a Sanskrit term, and there is a formula in Sanskrit that says Atma equals Brahma. Brahma referring to divine consciousness, and Atma referring to human consciousness. So at this level, our human consciousness is equated with divine consciousness. So it simply means that when we are able to realize our consciousness at this volitional level, this realization of our human consciousness is equated at the same time with divine consciousness. So the divine consciousness expresses itself at its fullest at this atmic level. The word atmic is simply an anglicized term for the word atma. Then she used the word buddhi to refer to the intuitional. The word buddhi comes from two in Sanskrit, and it comes from two root words in Sanskrit, bud, B-U-D, and then D-H-I, which simply means silence. So bud means to realize, and D means to realize silence. So to reach this intuitional, or to awaken this intuitional consciousness, or to let it function within our consciousness, there must be silence within our consciousness. In that silence, in that peace, in that quiet, then the intuition or buddhi now begins to express itself. Then Blavatsky used the word manas. When she uses the word manas, she simply refers to the mental. And the mental here includes now the abstractional and the rational together. The word manas is interesting. In the Philippines, there is one language there called Tagalog, which is the national language now. There is a word called, spelled like this, but it is pronounced manas. The accent is on the second syllable. And it simply means to swell, something that swells, something that expands. And if there is anything so swelling, obviously it is the mind. You know, we have the equivalent term swell-headed, and that begins here with this mind. That is quite an interesting association. Anyway, the word mana sometimes in Sanskrit is translated as the thinker. And this thinker is neither male nor female. In other words, there is no sex here. There is no gender. It is both male and female. And this is the thinker in us. And it is a principle within us that creates symbols to be able to understand within our consciousness. So the nature of our mental consciousness is that without symbols, it is not able to understand. And by symbols here, we refer to language. Then we might even include mathematics, which is a form of language. And through symbols and language, the mind now, or manas, is able to understand. through language and symbols, we create concepts, we create theories, and we create paradigms, and we create symmetries. And all of this is an attempt for the mind to understand, called manas. Then Blavatsky used the word kama rupa. The word rupa simply means form, and the word kama means emotion. By the way, in the Spanish language, the word kama also means bed. And most likely, maybe the association is that most emotions really are found in bed, which is kama in Spanish. So kama rupa means now the emotional form, or the form through which emotion expresses itself. Then she used the word linga sharira. This is again Sanskrit. And it is translated now as the etheric double. Now notice in our first column, the etheric physical now is one block here, and it is divided now into two. So when HPB or Blavatsky uses the word linga sharira, she separates this from what is called prana. The word prana is a Sanskrit word, and there are two root words here, pra and ana. The word pra simply means to go forth, and the word ana means food. And food now is associated with energy. So if we do not take food, we have no energy. So in a way, we can translate ana as energy and pra to go forth. So prana or praana, prana means energy that goes forth. And this is translated as the life breath. So this is the energy that flows now through the linga sharira, or the etheric double. And when we use the word etheric, we refer now to both prana, the life breath, and linga sharira, the etheric double. And then she speaks of matter, and when she says matter, she calls this gross matter. She speaks of our physical nature, solid, liquid, and gaseous, which we call now here the dense physical. Now, what we will do now is go across the board. So, Blavatsky uses the word gross matter to refer to our dense physical nature, and then A.P. Sinnett uses the word physical body to refer to our dense physical nature, and this is a level of consciousness to which we are familiar, and then Annie Besant uses the word dense physical. Leadbeater and Gina Raja Dasa uses the word physical, but when they use the word physical, they refer to the physical and etheric together. And therefore, under the Blavatsky classification, they include now prana and the linga sharira together. So if we read in our literature, when Blavatsky and Sinnett and Annie Besant speaks of the physical, they do not include prana, the linga sharira, or the etheric. They simply refer to the dense physical nature, which is the solid, liquid, and gaseous nature of our physical body. Of course, the solid part of our physical body are the bones, especially the most dense. Then we have the muscles and then the tissues. Then the liquid state would correspond now to the blood circulatory system, and then the gas now would be the air that we breathe through the lung. But there are other natures that go beyond the physical, dense physical, solid, liquid, and gaseous. Then at this second level here, third here in our septenary key, the emotional, Blavatsky uses the word kama rupa, and Sinnett uses the word astral vehicle. And the word vehicle is an eye symbol, because it's like a car. A vehicle is something that we ride, and this is a car or a vehicle that we ride through which we express our emotion. And they use the word astral because the word astral is associated with the word stars, asteres, and it has a star-like quality in the sense that at this level of consciousness, one observes this as shining in nature, very much like maybe if we look at the sea or the ocean, you know, if you're at the seashore, and then it's a dark night, let's say it's a moonlight night, then we look at the shimmering waters, And it is said that this astral looks like that. It shimmers, so astral-like, as if there are many stars that have fallen and they shimmer and shine, and they called it the astral. Annie Besant uses also the word astral, so with Leadbeater and so with Gina Rajadasa. So there is no difference at this level here. They all refer to our emotional level of consciousness. AP Sinet, by the way, uses the word jiva to refer now to this level of prana. So AP Sinet is almost one-to-one, the same as Blavatsky, except that at the level of prana or the life breath, he does not use this word, he uses the word jiva. The word jiva simply means like a center. So sometimes in our theosophical literature, the word jiva is used this way, that when we go to the kingdoms of nature, like let us say the animal kingdoms, the plant kingdom, and the mineral kingdom, it is said there are centers of consciousness here that are moving into the level of human consciousness. And these centers of consciousness have been called jiva, J-I-V-I. Now this jiva, or center of consciousness, when it moves now into the human state of consciousness, it now becomes jiva atma. So meaning to say, this is a jiva or center of consciousness now with an atma. This is our human nature. Then when this jiva atma realizes itself as the atma or the divine nature that transcends the physical, the emotional, the mental, and the intuitional, when it realizes that, then it is said to be a jivan mukta, J-I-V-A-N-M-U-K-T-A. The word mukta or mukti sometimes simply means someone who is liberated or free. So that state of liberated consciousness, or that state where consciousness now is free from the physical, the emotional, and the mental. So that is a liberated state of consciousness. And he is called now a jivan mukta. So first the jiva goes through the kingdoms of nature, then after that, it enters the human level of evolution. It becomes now a jiva atma, and when it realizes itself as the atma, transcending its lower natures, then it is now free and liberated, in the sense that it is spiritually free and spiritually liberated. Now it is called a jivan mukta. Then at the manas or mental level, Sinet uses the word manas, and Annie Besant uses the word causal, and she uses the word higher. When she says higher, she refers to the higher mental, and when she uses the word mental, she simply refers to the lower mental, which we call now the rational mental. So when Annie Besant in our literature discusses the mental, she is largely talking of the lower mental, or the rational mental in our key. Because then the causal or higher mental is something all by itself. She calls this causal because it causes things at this level. And the way it causes is this way. We were saying that the abstractional mental is the level of ideals. And according to the presence or absence of ideals, it will cause the kind of behavior or nature that we have at the lower mental, the emotional, and the physical. So our physical actions, our astral or emotions, and then our mental nature and ideas will behave and will be of the quality according to the absence and presence of these ideals at this causal level. And so she called it causal. So it causes to act accordingly. If the ideals are present, we act in a different way. If they are absent, then we act in the opposite way, whether at the physical, emotional, or rational mental level. Then the Leadbeater uses also the word mental, similar to Gina Rajadasa, and they take the lower and higher together. But sometimes Gina Rajadasa uses the word higher heaven and lower heaven. Higher heaven referring to that state of consciousness that refers to our abstractional mental. So we were saying that our abstractional mental is the realm of ideals. So if we live in a world where everything is ideal. Wouldn't that be really a heaven world? But he called it the higher heaven world. Then he called the lower mental the lower heaven world, in the sense that this is the realm of ideas, but the problems of the emotions and the problems that we have in our physical life do not enter here. And so he called it a kind of heaven, the heaven of ideas. You see, ideas do not get hungry. They do not suffer. They do not get hurt. How can you hurt an idea? People with ideas may get hurt, but the idea in itself has no hurt, has no suffering. So he called it lower heaven. But when he uses the word mental, he refers to both the rational and abstractional mental. Then he uses the word now intuitional to refer to the buddhic. Now, the only difference here at the atmic or volitional level is the word nirvanic used by Leadbeater and spiritual by Jina Rajadasa. So when the word spiritual is used by Jina Rajadasa, it is not a vague thing like something probably opposite to something material. So when he uses the word spiritual referring to our human consciousness, he refers to our volitional level of consciousness. And Leadbeater, this is a Buddhist term, nirvana, and it is anglicized now. He uses the word nirvanic. The word nirvana comes from two root words, nir and then vana. V-A-N-A, vana means like a flame or fire, something that is fiery, something that is flaming. And nir means no more. So when nir, vana are put together, it means the flame or fire that is put out, where it is no more. And that flame there is the flame of desires, our burning desires, our emotions, and the flaming ideas now that attach us to the material world. And in Buddhism, they call this the fire that we go through in life. We get burned by it. So, you know, we even use this now in our modern term, in human relationship. You know? We say, well, he or she got burned, you know. There is its fiery nature. But this now is a state of consciousness when one has realized this oneself as the atmic or nirvanic consciousness within oneself, then these fires now that burn in the lower world, physical, emotional, and mental, are now blown out. Maybe there is another fire that burns now. Maybe we can call this the fire of creation, the divine fire, a much higher kind of fire that does not bring suffering. And here now we have the correspondences. The beauty about this is that it points out that we have a level of consciousness within ourselves other than the physical, emotional, and mental. And it also points out that this level of consciousness are also level of existences all by itself. So as far as we are concerned, we are now in the physical world, so we have this physical body. This is an existence all its own. So there can be a level of consciousness corresponding to this. Without the physical, then we can have an astral level of consciousness, and this can have a level of existence all by itself. Without the bodies and vehicles at the emotional level, then there can be another level of existence or state of being at the mental level, and so on, at the intuitional, and then at the atmic or atma, nirvanic or spiritual level, according to the theosophical author we are referring to. Maybe we'll stop for a while here if you have some questions. Then there is another model that we can make and we will draw it. But before we go there, are there some questions you'd like to ask for clarification in this correspondence study? Yeah. The question is about etheric double. This is called the etheric double because it is said before the birthing of a child, the etheric double is already formed. And it is said to be a double because the physical body merely doubles and follows whatever is placed there in the etheric. So the etheric is a kind of mold or master plan along which the physical body grows. So there are those who are psychic enough maybe to see this etheric double, and then when they see this, then by maybe associating the features of the face, then they will say, well, your child is going to be a boy, maybe, or a girl, by associating with the features. So this is our counterpart. of our physical, dense physical body. When anesthesia is administered, the etheric double is said to be pushed out of the physical body. And so the etheric double now here actually is the vehicle of our sensations. The sensations that we feel are not in our consciousness, are not at the dense physical body level. They are at the etheric level of consciousness. This is where we feel sensations. All that the dense physical body does is to make contact through our senses with the object that we experience, through which we experience sensations. But these sensations are experienced at the etheric level. So when anesthesia is applied, like in an operation, it is said that the etheric double gets pushed out. That is why we have no feeling. We have no feeling of pain, because the sensation of pain now is at the etheric double. Sometimes, lately now, there are many books now and many allied groups and many spiritual groups. That is why in the notes that accompany that, I tried to put there the original copyright date when these ideas came out. So you will see there a year with a small letter C that goes before the year of publication. And that refers now to the copyright. That is how early it has come about. So Blavatsky goes back to maybe 1888, and then the others there. There is one probably that I missed there. It was Jina Raja Dasa. The copyright date of that was 1921, although the edition I consulted was 1967. But as the first edition of this book, which is the reference for this, First Principles, came as early as 1921. But nowadays, there are many books and spiritual groups now. It is spreading around. And they refer to this etheric double, but they do not use this term. They call this sometimes the energy body. Because all energies in the physical world flow through this etheric double. Why? Notice in the Blavatsky classification, we have the word prana. And this prana, or life breath, or energy, flows through this linga sharira, or etheric double. So the etheric double is what we might say like the electric wiring, and then the prana, or life breath, or energy, is the electricity flowing through it. So sometimes they call this now the energy body within us. This energy body is energized not only from the physical level, but also from the higher level. They get energized on both levels, but especially from the higher level. The study of the chakras, or called centers within our physical nature, have relationship also to this etheric double. So there are centers in this etheric double, and they are called the chakras. And that book is listed in the notes by Leadbeater. I understand in the publishing house, this is the top selling book for so many years. But many authors now use this, and lecturers, but they will not say they got it from there. But that is the original. So here we have it now, what you might call from the horse's mouth. Are there other questions you'd like to ask? Yes. Yes. The question is about death and the etheric body. We will discuss this in detail in our next meeting. But for now, we can mention it this way. That, let us say, our overcoat would be our physical body. Then we have our coat or dress underneath that. That would correspond to the etheric body. So during death, we shed aside our overcoat, and then we are now in our etheric body. Then it is said to... we stay there for about a few days, and usually one is unconscious. Then finally the consciousness withdraws from the etheric double. Now the the disintegration of the physical body goes hand in hand with the etheric double. So if the etheric double does not disintegrate, then the physical body takes a long time to disintegrate. That is why there are those who favor cremation, because then the fire is not only physical, it is also etheric. then it disintegrates immediately the etheric double. And this etheric double, because it is physical, but it is at the etheric level beyond the solid, liquid, and gaseous, sometimes we become sensitive and are able to see this. And this is what people call now as ghost, you know, the ghost. Well, the acupuncture, you mean the etheric body, yes. These two together, the etheric double and the jiva here, or the prana. So the pierce now, we were saying that this is a level here where energies come from the physical and the higher. Actually, it is a level where there is an exchange of energy. So most likely in acupuncture, maybe the needles there act as some kind of antenna where, just like you have your RTV or radio, where there is an interchange now of vibrations, so we are able to receive now vibrations. So energy vibrations now are received through what is called the needles that are put. And then, well, that is a whole study all by itself, depending on the nature of the metal, whether gold and silver and all its quality. Anyway, when it comes to acupuncture, there are 400 to 700 acupuncture points. But anyway, whatever this is, there is only one master acupuncture point, and that is the puncturing of the ego. That is the master acupuncture point. If one can puncture this master acupuncture point of the ego, it takes care of all the diseases and distresses that have to be cured in the rest of the 400 and 700 points that have to be punctured. Because if you look at our diseases and sicknesses, they can all be traced now to the ego. Somewhere there, the self and the ego and egotism and all that, they now relate to our diseases. And we will discuss this in probably more detail in our next meeting when we go to the study of karma and the way we exercise our consciousness and how we affect the laws of nature and how the laws of nature also affect the life that we live at these different levels, physical, emotional, and mental especially. Yes?
As long as the person is alive, they have to some degree each of the seven portions.
Yeah, we have all of this. If we are alive, then these are all present in us.
Right.
Yes.
And when we die, we drop one and enter two through seven.
Yes. Yes, we will discuss this in detail in our next meeting. But we can mention for now that when we die, you drop the physical body. We may not have a physical body, but we can still have physical consciousness of a different state. Not like the way we would have it as if we had a physical body. So through the physical body, the experiences that we have with the physical body and the consciousness that experiences it are confined really to the five senses. Now, tasting, seeing, feeling, and so on. But during death, then the physical experience transcends now the five senses. So that is a whole study all by itself. But maybe next time when we go to death, we will deal with that. Yes. But for now, these are centers of consciousness within us. And it is reassuring to know, at least even on a theoretical basis, that while we know only this physical consciousness confined to the five senses, it is reassuring to know, even theoretically, that there are higher and deeper levels of consciousness within our human nature, and they are already there. And then through this, they can be awakened to the life that we live, they can be awakened, and we can realize ourselves more than just physical body that gets hungry and that gets old and that dies and that suffers and that gets sick. That there is a level of existence and a level of consciousness that transcends the physical. Yes, okay. This is the thinker. Yes.
The thinker. So would you say that the etheric would be male or female?
We might even say the emotional is neither male nor female. It is only physical that is male or female. So that would include the etheric. Because the mold or pattern of the physical body is the etheric. So whether the organs, whether male or female, will develop will be according to the etheric body.
There are poles, like in the emotional, there is
Oh, yes. Polarity is throughout the entire universe and throughout all of these levels of consciousness.
But, okay,
yes. Well, let's say we are incarnated now, we have our physical bodies, and some of us are in male and female physical bodies. So if you're looking at polarity, we might say the male at the physical level in its polarity tends to be positive and then negative for the female. But at the astral level or emotional level, the female now is positive and the female is negative. Then when we go to the mental, the polarity reverses. The male now becomes positive, the female now is negative. Then when we come to the intuitional, the female now is positive, and then the male now is negative. And then at the atmic level, the male now is positive, and then the female now is negative. And then next higher level, the female becomes positive again. That is when we are in a physical body. That is the influence. Yes. Yes. The question is, what kind of experiences will one encounter when one practices astral travel? So the idea of astral travel is that power within our consciousness or power of consciousness where one is able to withdraw the emotional or astral body like one was in a sheath and then withdraw it from like the sword withdrawn from a sheath and then withdraw this astral body or astral consciousness and then travel. And the question is, what kind of experiences would one undertake? The physical world in which we live in has a counterpart in the astral world. And we will take this in some details in maybe our next meeting where, like people who die, they still do the same things that they do here in the physical world. Why? They are used to the things that they observe in the physical world. And there are counterparts at the astral world. So if they go to work, they go to the kitchen, they cook, and they work in their jobs, they still go on doing that, carrying on their habits. The only difference at the astral world or astral level of consciousness and our physical is this. The emotional or astral world of consciousness is very fluidic. It does not stay. It keeps changing. So I recall someone, it's a theosophist, a much elderly theosophist, jokingly this person said, "You know, my husband does not like when I change the furniture, in the house. He gets upset." I said, "Oh, this is the best time to adjust when things get changed in the physical world, because when you go to the astral plane, everything is changing every minute, probably even every second. So if we get used to changes and are able to adjust and flow with changes in the physical world, it is a great preparation also to that other side where things are constantly changing, things are fluidic. It is almost a world where whatever we think, we create and have immediately. So for example, in the physical world, if we wanted a chair, well, I was thinking of a wooden chair, but this would be more complicated. It's plastic because the technology here is a little bit, and you have an alloy here, which is aluminum. It's more complicated. But if this were a wooden chair, you'd maybe take a tree, then cut it down and make lumber. Now that it is plastic, now that's different. You'll have to get maybe now cellulose, and then goes through a manufacturing process then to extract this. Of course, these are actually grains, and then later on through high temperature, they melt this and so on. So with metallurgy for, let us say, the aluminum portion of this chair. And then we put this together by some carpentry, design, architecture. You put them together, then we have a chair. But in the astral world, it is instantaneous. All that one has to do is merely to think chair of whatever color and quality that we like, and it is there. That is why the extent to which we control our consciousness here in this physical world determines the kind of world that will await us when one enters this emotional world. Now, in astral travel, we withdraw into this world, and usually the momentum of our physical consciousness is carried here at this emotional level or astral level. So one can do astral travel, but if one does not have complete control, at least to a large extent, control of one's emotions and one's feelings, one may not probably be observing objectively what is taking place in that world or level of consciousness, but merely seeing the projections of one's own consciousness, the way we project here at the physical level. That is why to really understand astral travel and to give some kind of accurate description of what is taking in the astral world, part of the training, which includes meditation, and also the life that one lives, is complete control of one's emotions, so that the emotion and astral matter there does not interfere with one's observation. So we may be looking at something and we say, well, that is exciting. But what actually is happening is we are the ones that are excited. And that what we are seeing may not really be exciting. So we are merely projecting. And this is part of the astral training. And in fact, without this model, it is not possible to explain plain astral travel. So I'm glad this question has been brought up. But there are a number of groups now, they promise you almost instant nirvana or instant astral travel. My friends, it is not as easy as one might imagine. So there are those who are able to sort of do it naturally. And the explanation is that if reincarnation is so, that most likely in a past life one has worked along these directions, and so it becomes much more easy to do it, almost without maybe any effort, maybe in a next life. But normally it is not easy for one to do this. There are certain effects and after effects that go with it also. Unless one is careful, astral travel hastens the aging of the physical body, unless one is careful and one knows what one is doing. Because then we are extracting now this astral energy now from this etheric double and our dense physical body. And actually the energies that are found here really come from these higher levels above the etheric, that is the astral above. And so when we draw this, then the physical and etheric now is devoid of energy. And it hastens now the aging process, unless one is careful and one knows what one is doing. And part of that technique is that one charges first the physical and etheric before actually doing any astral travel. But one must know also how to charge that. But that is the principle that is involved. So in astral travel, if one can really do it, then you can go to a library and then look at the books and travel there. And at that level, one does not even have to pull out the books. You can look at any page that you want because the vision there is like almost X-ray vision. But it takes energy to use that, and we simply say that there is a higher form of energy that is used there. It is much more economical in terms of energy to go into the library physically and get the book and open it. You know, yeah, it is like, how's this? It's probably like gardening and then using a tractor, you know, to do maybe a small plot of vegetable gardening, and we're using a tractor. These are tremendous energies that are used. That is why people who have awakened some of these powers to whatever extent, part of the spiritual training, they would never use these energies right away to use these higher powers. They would do the ordinary things that we can do physically, because then the energies are saved and these higher energies are used now for the helping of the world rather than to satisfy one's curiosity. Oh, yes. They may or may not be, because they can also be unconscious, you know. So that which we say is in coma is the physical body that we observe. But as far as the consciousness is concerned, it may either be in coma at the etheric and astral level, or it may also not be. But from the physical observation point of view, we see the body and we say, now the body now is in coma. So it depends on the consciousness. If it is awake, then the consciousness is not in coma. But it can also be in a state of unconsciousness. Yeah, and usually what happens, when it is a state of unconsciousness, it is wrapped up by the by the etheric double. One must be able to withdraw from it to be able to experience. Yes. Yes.
And
oh, yes, yes, it is possible. It is possible to watch when one withdraws. The problem is if one is able to carry the memory. So there are some who are able to, after the operation, come back to their physical body, and they carry the memory, and then they, you know, they may say that they have experienced it. Now, some may experience it, but do not carry the memory, and so when they are back in their physical brains, they say, I didn't experience anything, but actually they did. And it is very much like the dream state. Yes, please. Yes, please.
It's stated somewhere too that every time we sleep, our astral body leaves our physical body and go off wandering.
Yes, yes.
Based on your theory of energy being
yes.
off, I could think that every time we sleep, then, and if that is true, our body, instead of being lifted, would become more tired.
Yes.
Is there a fallacy there?
Oh, in fact, I'm sure some of us, when they dream, when you wake up, you were so exhausted about the dream. So there are a number of things that can happen here in the dream state. First of all, one can imagine that one is traveling astrally when actually one has not been traveling. One is merely within one's astral body and involved now with all the emotions and thought emotions within one's own body and feel that one is traveling. But they are all happening merely within one's consciousness. And the other is where one is actually traveling and moving around. So only the person can say that for himself or someone who will really sort of observe, you know, what is happening. Now, lately there have been some researches now about sleep, but they are not going really into astral travel. They just, all they do is take pictures of people who are asleep and that they're lying now on the right side and then after so many minutes, then the left side, and they have what they call REM, rapid eye movements, where the movements go, but you observe it. One can observe this. See, in one's breathing, the left and right nostrils tend to alternate naturally on its own. Now you will find, don't agree with this, observe it. It seems that the physical body, if it's lying down on the right side, the moment the left nostril, the right nostril, on what side you're lying, that nostril on that side will tend to get clogged up or close. More air will go through the left. And when the moment is clogged up, it will be natural for the body now to turn left. By the way, in some of the science experiments, they're not able to explain why the body turns left or right. They say maybe the muscles there are tired and so on. But really, it is moving in accordance with the breath. This is just a theory, but you can observe this for yourself in your own consciousness. So if you find that your right nostril is clogged up, lie on the left side, and that right will clear, and the left one will clog. But we do this in life. If one is aware of one's breath, although two nostrils are functioning, one tends to take more air than the other. And actually what it is doing is balancing the energies that is flowing through the body.
Yes.
There is none. There is none. So when the question is there a difference between astral travel and astral projection? So when we say astral travel, we are projecting now the astral body so that it travels. So when we say astral travel, it's merely a kind of projection. They call it projection because one thinks about it. You know, we project ideas. So in this case now, we project now the astral body. And this occurs, the natural development of this occurs during the meditative process. Well,
you consciously do not have to aim in that direction, it's just a natural evolvement?
Yes. What one does is in the meditative process, a time comes when you just shoot out what you just say. Before you know it, oh, is this it? That all that I have been reading about? Oh, this is interesting. You just shoot out. And then by that time, then you can investigate and say, now what's going on here? But before that, they are largely just ideas that we project in our minds. It can be done either maybe in the physical world, physical consciousness, when we sit down and meditate. Sometimes also it can happen during the sleep or dream state. So if you're reading these theosophical books and ideas like this, and then we're dreaming now, and then we can remember what we read, you know, in our physical consciousness. Oh, I remembered down there they said it is this. Let me find out now. That is another way that can happen. So I recall some theosophists who are approaching they're in terminally ill, you know, and they're about to die. And while others are so worried, you know, that they're going to die, here they are so excited. They say, well, I want to review my theosophy, you know, so that when I get there on the other side, I'm really going to check this. So if one can remember that is another way of verifying for oneself. But the important thing is it is not possible to understand the processes that take place there unless one has, to some extent, some control over one's emotions and one's thoughts, because they immediately influence that state of matter. So the moment we think of certain things, for example, you know, some people, let's say they travel, and when they're traveling, physically, I mean, then they get homesick, so they're thinking of their homes. So one can be traveling, let's say, probably there are people who travel to the Arab countries now, so they may be in an Arab country, but if they are homesick, they may be there astrally, but actually they will not see it. What they will see is their home, because they're homesick. They're thinking of their home. So what we think happens there, and that becomes our environment. So in a way, even the physical environment that we have is a product of our thinking. And so likewise, in the astral world only, the environment there that materializes is instantaneous. When we think, it is there right away. There was a hand, someone who didn't ask a question. No, all right, yes.
4 and 5,
yes. Oh, yes, the rational abstraction, yeah. Yes. Yes. Well, these are some studies now of what they call the theory of the bicameral brain. And most likely, this one would be the right brain, the rational. the left side, yeah, from the right, yeah, it crosses. And then the right side would be the obstructional. Yeah, that is one theory. Probably you have come across, I'm sure most of us have, where in some spiritual practices they have what they call the repetition of a mantra, you know, or a word. So what happens there is that there is a kind of, the moment we have an idea, like a word, that we keep repeating, then we are using now a rational mental, and then we overload now the left brain. We overload it. So the moment the left brain becomes overloaded, naturally, the excess energy now, because it's overloaded there, will shift now to the right brain. And maybe this might be the physiological explanation of the mantra. So you keep repeating. And that boredom is when one gets bored, that is the time to continue. Then we are overloading now the left brain. When it gets overloaded, then all the neural impulses that are generated due to the repetition of the mantra shifts now to the right brain and therefore activates the astral, the obstructional mental nature. Then one becomes now creative, what they say. Yes, that is one association that they have now. But really, the physiological counterpart really is not so much the left and the right brain as much as that it is really the pineal and pituitary gland in the brain. The pineal and pituitary gland. That's the one. This pineal and pituitary gland is what corresponds in the Bible to the gland of milk and honey, you know, symbolically. Because the pineal gland secretes an oil that is honey in color, yellowish, and the pituitary gland secretes an oil that is milkish in color. And this is the land of milk and honey that the Israelites were looking for. The Israelites are symbol of humanity, because during those days, they thought the entire Israel nation was the whole world, you know. Their geography, of course, was probably limited, but Israel refers to the entire of humanity. And it is the land of milk and honey to which we enter into as a level of consciousness. So in certain meditative states, this pineal and pituitary gland gets activated. And it is the chemistry of these oils, of the pineal and pituitary gland, that creates the physiological conditions so that the higher levels of consciousness becomes a waking consciousness experience in the physical world, yes, rather than some kind of projection or imaginary thing that we have in our consciousness. See, we'll go back to questions again. This one can be diagrammed in another way, and it will be easier to remember it. So we will draw it here. So we can visualize our human nature and our levels of consciousness from a five-pointed star point of view. So here's one, and here it is easy to remember this. This is our human nature. We will call this the because it's five, the pentagram, we will just call this the pentadic view. So at the top here, we will have the volitional. And then here we will have the intuitional. And then opposite this, we will have the mental. And both abstractional and rational. And then here we will have the emotional at the bottom point of the star. And then we have now the physical. So this is our human nature, and we have now our five levels of consciousness here. And in a way, even our physical body is like a star. So you have the legs as the bottom of the star, and this side here would be the arms, and this would be the head. So even our human physical body is five-pointed. The head, the two arms, and then the two legs. Then we can call this this is pentadic, penta, meaning five. We can call this the hexadic view. There are six. And the hexadic view would be an upright triangle here like this to represent now the volitional and then the intuitional. And then we have now the mental, which we split this into two now, so we have now the abstractional. Then we make now an inverted triangle here. So we have the six-pointed star here now. So down below the inverted triangle, we will have the physical consciousness. And then here above the abstractional, we will have now the rational. And then above the intuitional, now we have the emotional. So we will call this the hexadic view of our human nature and our consciousness. And here is now the septenary view, or septadic. Septenary, but we are using the word septadic, so it will rhyme. It's just poetic. But it means seven. So, and this is the classical theosophical diagram that they use to refer to our human nature. So they draw here an upright triangle. Let's move this here to the left. Like this. And then they draw a square here. So this upper triangle will be like this hexadic view here. So this would be the volitional at the top. And then the abstractional here. And then we have the intuitional. So the counterpart of the abstractional would be the rational. And then the emotional. This is, we are at the square now. And then with the physical now is divided into two. We have the etheric here, the lower portion of the square, and now the dense physical. All right. Now, this here, this is an unusual bracket. It points that way, but now it points in the reverse. This sometimes is referred to as the personality. Sometimes they refer to this as the psyche. Sometimes the quaternary is referred to as the mortal self. Sometimes it is referred to as the selfish self. You know, it thinks of itself. And sometimes it is referred to as the lower quaternary. So these are some basic theosophical terms, and they refer to the physical, etheric, emotional, and rational taken together. And of course, they're joined together. And this upper triangle is referred to, this is the personality, and this is now our spirituality. Since this is the psyche, we will invent a term now for this upper triangle that is the counterpart of the psyche. Jung used to talk about a personality type, Carl Gustav Jung. He talks about a personality type and that there is a personality archetype. So every personality type has an archetype. So if we have a psyche, then there might be an archetype of this psyche. So we will call that the archetype. There's no such word in the English language. We're just inventing it. So the archetype. So the upper triangle is the archetype, and this is the psyche, the lower quaternary. Since this is the mortal self, the square here, the triangle now will be the immortal self. The quaternary now is the selfish self, so this now will be the selfless self. Then this is now called the upper triad. This is the lower quaternary, the upper triad, three, the triangle. So these are some terms that are used to refer to our human nature. In probably the closest correspondence of this to our religious, the religious view of looking at our human nature, this upper triad may be viewed as the soul, then the physical here now would be the body, of course, and then the rest of this, the etheric, the rational, and the mental, is probably what in Christianity is called the devil in us. So we will put here it in close quotation, you know, the devil in us. You see, the etheric is the energy, this is the energy body. So it's lots of energy. If there are no ideals to guide that energy probably could be misused. It can be misused, malused, and so on, disused. Then the soul here, when it is divorced now from, does not guide now this lower quaternary, then the emotions now can go on its own, devoid of ideals found in the abstractional. So with the rational mental, it will exercise certain ideas that are now divorced from the ideals within one's consciousness. And that is what we call now the devil in us. There are states of meditation, and we will take this up, particularly in the last meeting. We have two more, where what one does in the meditative process symbolically is to raise one's consciousness from the personality into what we call now our spirituality, which is the upper triad. And this is like symbolically a kind of channel through which we enter now with our consciousness to realize ourselves now as this triangle instead of this square down below. Sometimes they call this the higher self, also is another word, higher self. And then this is called now the square here, sometimes called the lower self. So these are some terms used by different writers and authors in our theosophical literature that are scattered around, but they refer to this upper triangle here and this lower square here. And this is merely a diagram and a model, but this really is our human nature. These are levels of consciousness within us. But usually our consciousness is confined largely to this physical nature. We don't even see our etheric nature. The aura that some people are able to observe is really the etheric expression of the etheric aura here. Now we can have some questions. Yes.
Going back to your question about meditation, that you said that the questionnaire is to raise itself up to the triangle.
Let's just maybe restate that. It's not so much that the quaternary goes there. It is the consciousness that is locked in here or caught in here that withdraws from this now and raises itself here to this triangle to realize itself now as the volitional, abstractional, and the intuitional consciousness within oneself. Taken as a whole, we simply say this is the soul in us, to know oneself as the soul rather than the personality. Yes.
My question is,
yes. What does it do?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the question is, what does the triangle do to this square here? First of all, it gives life to this square here. If this withdraws, this disintegrates and may not probably exist all by itself. Maybe for a while, but finally it has no direction. So it gives direction to this. And what it does is that it tries to express its full powers, the triangle here, on the lower planes, or the lower quaternary. All our potential for perfection are found here in this upper triad, but they are not fully expressed here in this lower quaternary. So the life one lives, and the meditative process that one does is to draw these higher spiritual energies so that it may transform this quaternary here so that it can be a full expression of the spirituality that is our higher self. The meditative process opens the channel, and the life that we live now makes use of that channel for these spiritual energies to express themselves in the lower worlds or on this square here. And of course, as one expresses it all the more, these higher energies, the channel also expands, symbolically expands itself, until finally one realizes oneself as merely this totality, as oneself. A good example of this would be, you know, if we are walking on the seashore, there are really three substates of physical matter that are involved. So the sand on which we're walking, the water, let's say the shore is up, the water is up to our knee, so we experience the liquid state of physical matter. And then above the knee would be the air. While we experience this separately, if we focus our consciousness, that experience of solid ground and the water of the ocean, liquid, and the gaseous, the air, is really one experience. But by focusing, we can separate the air experience. We feel the wind blowing maybe in our face, the water, cold or hot, and then the ground under our feet. So there is a level of development where finally, while this is separate, the physical, emotional, and so on, upwards, up to the volitional, they may appear to be separate. And a time comes when one realizes oneself as merely just one consciousness. And those who have realized this are called the perfected beings, masters, adepts, which we will discuss in our last meeting. Yes. Oh, yes, that's right. Yes. Uh-huh, yes, that's right, holistic. Yes. Uh-huh. The self is self, yes. Yes. Uh-huh. Yes. Yeah, it appears to be a division, but the physical body, it is natural for the physical body to be selfish by itself. You know, when it's hungry, it looks for food. You know, when it's cold, it tries to wrap itself up. You know, and then it looks, you know, like this is selfish. But in relation to another human being, this selfless self may deny that selfish, the natural selfishness of the physical body. So it says, well, you're hungry, but here is this person that is more hungry than you are, then you share it with him, you know, or share whatever you have. So this selfish self is there, but the moment the selfless self rules this selfish self, then we might say one is acting from this level. So this selfish self is of the nature of the personality. But the moment one acts from the nature of the upper triad, or the soul, or the spiritual self, then this now rules the selfish self. Then you can tell the selfish self, well, this is not the time to be selfish. You got to share. But if one is by oneself, then you say, well, I will allow you to indulge a little. About, wait a minute, you know. Don't get carried over. So this rules now this lower quaternary. Yes.
Yes.
Grace? Well, grace is really like God's blessing. So we might say the energy now, that spiritual energy that flows down here into the personality is what we might call now like spiritual grace. Spiritual grace. Yes. Pardon?
The example she's using of grace wouldn't the contrary be guilt. Your lower nature, rule over yourself itself, you're creating guilt.
Yes. Yes, guilt is when the polarity now of the ideals and the ideas now are there, you know, they're opposed to each other. And then finally, the ideas now are able to take over the ideals. Then there is a feeling now of guilt. But there are types of guilt that are really imposed on our consciousness, more by customs and traditions. So there would be a kind of guilt that we might call a real ethical guilt, and one that is merely imposed by customs and tradition. We might probably differentiate that. Yes.
Yes. Being talked about the pineal and the pituitary gland.
Yes.
During meditation, is it possible to feel these glands activated or not?
Yes, it is possible. You can feel it. In fact, you can get a foretaste of how it feels. Well, we'll do something, but don't go around, you know, say, oh, you know, being said this and all that. Because that is not our purpose. But just to get a foretaste of that feeling. And by the way, don't practice this and don't do it, because we may not know what is happening. You put your tongue against your... you see your lip, no, inside, you put your tongue and press against it. We may not look beautiful, you know. Just push. Just push hard with the tongue, the tip of the tongue, the inside of the upper lip. All right? Then you go now clockwise as if you are the clock. You go around. So move it to the right, pushing against the inner lip, going around the mouth. Push hard and go around that. From 3 to 7 times, you will feel something. You really push hard and go around. What do you feel? you feel something there. Actually, what is happening is, see, because the jaws here and the tongue, they're all connected to what is called in physiology, the trigeminal nerve. And the trigeminal nerve, somewhere at the root, is the closest to this gland. So the moment you do this, and the thing is to do it until it tires, and the muscles tire. And when you exercise that, blood rushes also. So it goes now somewhere there. And the feeling is something like that. Yeah. But when one is meditating, realization is not, oh, I'm feeling this thing in my head, now I've realized. No, it's not like that. That is of secondary nature. It is totally something else, and that is merely incidental. And some people say, well, if that is not the sign that I feel something in my head, then how do I know I'm realizing? It's very simple. If the realization is for real, there's no question about it. Yeah, if there is a realization, and then when we get out of the meditation, or whether we are, it can happen in between meditations, and then after that we say, I wonder whether that was it. The moment the question arises, it is not it. Because if it is it, there is no question about it. Yeah. It's like very simple, you know, you eat a cake and it tastes good, and somebody asks, does it taste good? Is it good? They say, well, I'm not sure. And you let somebody taste, and then you compare notes. Because if it tastes good, there's no question about it. You taste it, is it good? You say, yeah, it's good, terrific. And that realization is also like that. So people go around and say, I wonder if I've realized. If that question arises, for sure, 100%, it is not it. Because if it is it, no question about it. Yes. Yes. Number five, yes. Yes. Well, the question is, if I get it, is about the abstractional in relation to maybe energies. In that second sheet that you have there, other than the chart, down below there, it says there, because this is part of the answer, says there, our septenary universe and our human nature may be viewed as, and there are seven views there. So this applies to the abstractional and all the other levels, all the other enumerations that we have. So it can be viewed, abstractional or the others, can be viewed as states of matter. They can be viewed as types of energy also. So, and matter and energy are interchangeable. Then you can view them also as, you can view them as space-time dimensions. So we discussed this. So the fourth dimension would be above the physical, and then most likely the others, we either keep adding one, two, or three dimensions, depending on how we add it. Then it can be viewed also as degrees of manifestation, in the sense that there is a spiritual reality that manifests itself in the lower worlds of matter, so the abstractional, the rational, down to the physical, then going up to the volitional. Each of these are levels of manifestation or degrees of manifestation of spiritual reality. Then they can be viewed also as fields of evolution. So in the physical world, evolution and development is taking place. At the emotional, this is one level of evolution and development. So with the rational and the abstractional, they can be viewed as fields of development and evolution. Then they can be viewed also as states of being, or a state or a condition of existence. So there can be, at the abstractional level, a condition of existence all by itself that is separate from the rational, the emotional, and the physical. including the etheric, all by itself. Then it can be viewed also as now as levels of consciousness. And all these levels of consciousness ultimately are really just one consciousness, and that is the consciousness of the divine. But at our level of human consciousness, they appear to be separate. So, like when we began, when this Atma, human consciousness, becomes one with the divine Brahma or Brahmic consciousness, and Atma equals Brahma, the human now is equivalent to the divine, then while we enumerate this, all these enumerations are simply one grand level of consciousness. This is what we might call now the unified consciousness. Well, all right, we are at our time now, so if it's all right with you, there are two more hands here, so I'll come back to you. Yes. Yes, I know what you mean. Mm-hmm.
What would the second or the etheric type of energy be? Or how would you say that?
Oh, the etheric energy would be now nuclear energy, chemical energy, electromagnetic energy, and thermal or thermodynamic energy would correspond to that. Yes. Then the solid liquid gaseous would be mechanical energy for solid, pneumatic energy for gaseous, hydraulic energy for liquid. Yes, I guess one can say that. Yes, I guess that we can say that. Actually, we are saying this at the mental level. So if we say, I am more than my consciousness, it takes a consciousness to know that one is more than one's consciousness. You know, I mean, that is the thing. Now, this is not a limitation, you know, of our understanding. It is a limitation of words through which we are trying to express an understanding deep within us, because we are that truth and we are that reality. So in our next meeting, we will take up particularly the laws of consciousness, which are really the laws of karma, and we will touch on reincarnation. And that'll be an interesting session. I'm sure you have many, many more questions to ask, but this will be a very practical approach, because this is something that we can use in the life that we live. The consciousness that we exercise in accordance with the laws of nature, and they are not only physical laws, they are the laws that govern the emotional and the mental levels of consciousness for our universe. Have a nice evening.